Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Vatican issues a new set of norms concerning the most serious crimes, including sex abuse by clergy. The Church of England moves one step closer to the consecration of women bishops. And Rights Here, Right Now, an international AIDS conference opens next week in Vienna. Hear from one of the Catholic Church's leading experts in the fields of care and prevention. The Vatican on Thursday made public a new set of norms regarding the most serious crimes, including desecrating the Eucharist, violating the seal of the confessional, sexual abuse of minors or the mentally impaired, ordaining women, and the possession or sale of child pornography. These modifications to a 2001 motu proprio were issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and you can find the full text, together with a note from Vatican spokesman Father Federico Lombardi on our website www.vaticanradio.org/English. The Church of England has moved one step closer to the consecration of women bishops during a highly charged debate at its General Synod meeting in the northern city of York this week. A narrowly defeated vote in one of the Synod's three houses of bishops, clergy and laity means there'll be few concessions made to traditionalists who have been strongly opposed to the move. They had hoped for safeguards that would allow them to remain in the care of male-only bishops, similar to the kind of compromise agreement reached when women were first ordained to the priesthood. Pro-women ordination campaigners claimed such concessions would lead to a two-track episcopacy, which could weaken the authority of both male and female bishops. Reverend Jonathan Boardman is Archdeacon of Italy and Malta and a member of the General Synod's House of Clergy. I contacted him on the concluding day of the meeting to find out more about these developments and their implications for relations with other churches.
The atmosphere was extremely charged. I've been a member of General Synod for 5 years, and this was undoubtedly the most emotionally weighty moment of my deliberations. But Philippa, I do need to tell you that although it looks as though we've decided definitively about accepting women bishops, it is important to remember that this is just another stage in a long process of scrutinising draft legislation. And in fact, what we've decided this time is a set of proposals of how to proceed, which are now being passed to the local church, the dioceses of the Church of England, to be discussed at their synods and also at the even more local level of deanery synods.
So in fact, although this was an important milestone, it doesn't mean by any means that it's the end of the debate or that women will be ordained by the end of the year.
Absolutely not. In fact, the very earliest possibility of ordination of women bishops will be in 2014. But it is a milestone in that draft legislation has now passed to a new stage, that the first clause of the legislation is specific in planning for the consecration of women bishops. What has been the main point at issue is the degree to which, within that provision, allowance could be made for those with conscientious objections to receiving their ministry.
As you say, much of the debate has been over this very point, to allow those opposed to women bishops the possibility of some kind of alternative, a sort of compromise measure. But this was very narrowly rejected, wasn't it, by just one of the three houses of Synod?
Yes, it was the House of Clergy within the Synod who voted against an amendment which was tabled by the two Archbishops of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York, to provide a kind of parallel jurisdiction within dioceses so that where there was a woman bishop, those who were opposed could receive episcopal ministry only from a male bishop acceptable to them, i.e. a male bishop who hadn't consecrated or ordained women as bishops and priests.
And yet this very narrow majority, if you like, against such a compromise shows that it's still an incredibly divisive issue.
Indeed, it is a divisive issue. And that, if you like, is the reason why it was so emotionally charged. Even those who did vote in the House of Clergy have repeatedly said that they don't want to reject the inclusion of those with conscientious objections. And indeed, the draft legislation as it's going forward makes considerable provision and is seen as a compromise from the point of view of those in favour of women's ordination and consecration as bishops. But it's not a compromise that has been identified as sufficient for those with strongly held views in the opposition.
So what reactions do you think are we likely to see from those traditionalists who cannot accept this development?
I think some now will take this as a point at which they truly decide whether to stay or leave the Church of England. And I do think it might mean that the Pope's Anglicanorum Chaetibus proposals of receiving groups of Anglicans into the Roman Catholic Church might have more go in it now. However, there's still a long way to go, and people with conscientious objections tend to be quite resistant and tenacious. I think many will continue to put their point of view across right to the very end. And what's very interesting about those who are fighting to stay, even against their consciences, is the degree to which they identify themselves very strongly as members of the Church of England. And even if from a traditionalist Catholic position within the Church of England, they don't identify themselves yet as Roman Catholics.
Now, both Rowan Williams, as you said, and John Sentamo, the Archbishops of Canterbury and York, had supported some kind of compromise proposal, which was defeated. Does this therefore weaken their position of leadership now?
The Archbishop of Canterbury, in his presenting of the amendment, said that it was in no way a test of loyalty. And in fact, it's interesting that in the House of Bishops, 15 bishops out of 40 voted against the Archbishop's amendment. That's clearly, they still had a majority in that House, but 15 is a significant number of bishops to decide not to vote with the Archbishops. The Archbishops have a particular duty to try and seek unity, and they were doing that in relation to their amendment, I think. They have undoubtedly been seen to be acting in a way which was caring of the conscientious objectors, if you like. And I think that will, in the long run, assist them in future conversations with them.
What about the ecumenical impact of this decision on relations, particularly with the Catholic and Orthodox worlds? I mean, was there much discussion of this at all in Synod this time?
It's a very interesting question, because actually procedurally, during consideration of legislation at the stage we've got to in this debate, the ecumenical observers aren't actually, by standing order, permitted to speak in debates, which is a great shame, because they all have, both from the Catholic and Orthodox side and from the Reformed Church's side, have much to contribute. However, they had been consulted before we got to this stage, and indeed in the Roman Catholic world, Cardinal Casper made a number of interventions, both to the House of Bishops of the Church of England and at the Lambeth Conference, dealing with this subject, in which it was made quite clear that if we ordained women bishops at all, this would be a further obstacle to organic unity with the Catholic Church. However, what I would also say importantly is that if we do ordain women bishops, which we are now set to do, it would be more important to keep a way of ordaining them which was more consonant with ecclesiology of the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Churches for our women bishops. And in that respect, that would argue against giving too many compromises and allowing too many conscientious objectors, because in fact, Catholic-minded supporters of the ordination of women as bishops say it's important that the role of the bishop is not damaged and their authority and their service to the Church in being a focus of unity. And therefore, that's why women have to be bishops, simply that, and not be compromised bishops.
I think these latest developments will help to focus very seriously the minds of those who are being drawn to represent both the Anglican Communion and the Catholic Church within the ARCHIC 3 talks.
Monsignor Andrew Faley is Assistant General Secretary in charge of ecumenical and interreligious relations at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. He told me while these latest developments represent a significant setback to the goal of full visible unity between the churches, they may also bring a greater clarity to discussions between the denominations.
I think the reaction will be very measured in terms of England and Wales. The bishops here are generously and wholeheartedly committed to ecumenical relations with all the church traditions within these two countries. And I see no change in terms of their continuing to relate very generously towards their episcopal colleagues within the Church of England for the future. And that will be symbolized very richly during Pope Benedict's visit to these countries, to the United Kingdom in September, when our bishops will meet with their Church of England bishop colleagues in Lambeth Palace.
So you wouldn't agree with those who are calling this another cloud on the horizon, another milestone, if you like, taking us further away from any hopes of visible unity?
Oh, no, I think it is a cloud on the horizon. I would say that it's nearer to us than the horizon, in that the way the Church of England is debating and drawing up its legislation in order to accommodate women within the episcopacy is, I think, changing the Church of England's understanding of itself as a church. That is a much more fundamental concern and worry for us as Catholics relating to Anglicans ecumenically. And I think we have to wait to see how that moves through the Church of England's discussions. But it seems to me to be a very clear cloud on the horizon.
What impact do you think this will have on those who are considering taking up the Pope's offer, Anglicanorum Chaetibus, the personal ordinariate?
I think Anglicanorum Chaetibus, recognizing the generosity of the Holy Father towards those Anglicans around the world within groups who wish to seek full communion with the See of Peter, will continue to be attractive to those here in our countries of England and Wales, especially as our bishops have already made clear that they will provide generously for those groups of former Anglicans. And I think the current situation within the Church of England will make some people think very carefully about what that offer will provide for them in terms of security and stability for their own lives as Christians within full communion as Roman Catholics with the See of Peter and, of course, with the bishops here in England and Wales.
Although you've said previously that this offer from the Pope is not to be seen as some kind of escape hatch simply for those who can't cope with the idea of women as bishops.
That's right, and it is not an escape hatch, and I'd stand by that phrase. The reality of the ordinariate is recognizing the generosity of what the Pope is providing within the Catholic Church, having reshaped the Catholic Church to provide that space for those who see the full nature of the Church to lie within the Catholic Church. And I think that always remains much more important as the issue that draws people into communion with the Catholic Church than feeling disaffected for one reason or another with what their church may be doing.
During his last visit here to Rome, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Rowan Williams, urged his Catholic listeners at a lecture at the Gregorian University to actually consider this issue more deeply, to consider the Catholic Church's own attitude towards these issues of authority and identity, and to consider whether perhaps this issue of ordination of women is not something of first order within the Church, but something that can be debated even within the Catholic Church. What was your reaction to that?
I think it was a very interesting and helpful distinction between first and second order issues as the Archbishop reflected on them within that lecture within the Gregorian University. However, I still think the more deep concern I have, and I think many Catholics would have, is how we understand the Church, what we understand the Church to be. And that debate, which Cardinal Casper brought particularly into focus in his contribution in his lecture to the Church of England House of Bishops some years ago, which he reiterated during the Lambeth Conference of 2 years ago, and which Cardinal Murphy O'Connor also focused on in his address to General Synod 2 Februarys ago, still continues, I think, to be the more serious, I might use the phrase, first-order issue, what it means to be the Church. And that, it seems to me, is something that the debate around the ordination of women as bishops needs to be returned to very seriously within the theological reflections that the Church of England, I think, still needs to take forward within its own debates. It's not just about legislation, it's about what it means to be the Church.
My thanks there to Monsignor Andrew Faley, Assistant General Secretary in charge of Ecumenical and Interreligious Relations at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And earlier you heard Reverend Jonathan Boardman, Archdeacon of Italy and Malta and a member of the General Synod's House of Clergy. Rights Here, Right Now is the theme of the 17th International AIDS Conference, which opens in Vienna this weekend. The six-day meeting brings together scientists, government and community leaders, donors and UN agencies, all working in the fields of HIV/AIDS care and prevention. Held every 2 years, the conference offers a chance to assess new scientific knowledge, discuss vital funding and learn from best practice being developed among communities most affected by the pandemic. Among those taking part is Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Global Catholic Confederation of Aid and Development Agencies, Caritas Internationalis.
Well, the focus, as the title indicates, is on human rights. And there are a number of different facets of human rights that I believe will be emphasized during this conference. Perhaps the most important is the right to health and the right to access to treatment. This is a big issue now because of the global economic crisis and the fact that a number of governments that had promised to give substantial funding for antiretroviral medications seem to be rethinking that, either based on their own economic difficulties or on the belief, and I would question this belief, but on the belief that this is going to be a kind of permanent drain on the economies of some of the more wealthy countries to fund this kind of treatment in the resource-poor countries.
So what kind of action can you take here, as you say, in the midst of this economic crisis? What kind of approach will the conference be taking to try and keep this at the top of the agenda?
Well, certainly this is a conference that will be attended by probably about 25,000 people, scientists, clinicians, activists, government leaders, and those from non-governmental organizations, including many faith-based organizations, that are actually delivering the services, especially in the developing countries. So one thing that will happen is that there will be reports on the success of these treatment programs, the fact that with these antiretroviral treatments, people are living longer, and they're beginning now to be able to be reintegrated into society to work once again to care for their families. And I think this will have to be an important emphasis coming out of the conference to show that, yes, it's costly to maintain these treatment programs, but it's an investment in the future development of these countries. Whereas previously, when people did not have any treatment, then many of them were sick for a long period of time, drained the medical structures in the countries, and then also because of the premature deaths of people in their middle years, then left many, many more orphans and dependent people who still were draining the society. So I think we have to see these treatment programs as a real investment in development.
Now, a lot of this work is going on in the developing world, and previous conferences have been held in places like Mexico City or Bangkok. Why do you think Vienna has been chosen for this one?
I think Vienna has been chosen for this one because of a real need to focus on the situation in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia. The epidemics have arrived there later, probably because under the old Marxist governments, these countries were quite isolated and didn't have as much travel in and out of the country, and so there was less spread of HIV as a result of that. Now, since these countries have opened up to the rest of the world, we see that there's been the spread of the virus, both by sexual means, but also by injecting drug use. And there's still a great deal of stigma and discrimination toward people living with HIV and AIDS all over the world, but especially in this part of the world, in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia. So I think that the planners of the International AIDS Conference saw it as time to choose a place that was close to this region of the world and to try to involve more of the government officials and the scientists and the clinicians from that part of the world.
Now, the Catholic Church will be holding its own pre-conference meetings, won't it, there in Vienna, and you're addressing some of these sessions as well as an interfaith session. Can you tell us a bit more about this specific focus from faith-based groups?
Yes, while the faith-based groups certainly are involved in the larger conference, It's also been felt by a number of faith-based groups, including Catholic ones, that it's necessary to bring the people involved in faith-based activities together to help them share their own experiences and also to help them be inspired and enriched by their own unique missions, faith-based missions, when they come together during these conferences. First of all, during the main conference, there often is a lot of criticism. I think it's unwarranted and unmerited criticism against faith-based groups. And so a lot of times people working in faith-based activities feel discriminated against themselves. And also, it's very, very important for faith-based organizations to understand what a great burden of care and of education they take with regard to HIV and AIDS and to learn from each other as they share their experiences. So the Catholic networking sessions will be held on Friday afternoon and Sunday morning. And we have more than 100 people coming from Catholic agencies and religious orders from all over the world to share with each other during that time. We'll also spend some time for them to have some workshops so that they could learn from the experiences of others. And some of the workshop topics involve how to help people learn to do positive living with HIV and AIDS. We're in a transition era where previously a lot of the AIDS programs were developed to help people die with dignity as a result of AIDS. Now we want to help them live since they have access, more and more have access to these life-saving medications. We'll also have workshops on ethical issues related to HIV and AIDS, on how to care for children. In Eastern Europe, we still have many HIV-positive children being abandoned in the maternity hospitals with no place to go, and so many of the Catholic organizations are starting programs that they'd like to share their experiences for.
You're talking about helping people live longer with these antiretroviral drugs, and in fact, you'll be talking about this question of universal access. How far have we got on that? How much further is there still to go before this becomes a reality?
Well, we have about 5 million people now out of the 10 million HIV-infected people who need access to these medications, whose disease is so far advanced that they need to have these medications in order to live longer. So about half of them have access to the medications. That's a long way compared to just a few years ago when very, very few in developing countries had access to the medications. However, it's still 50% lower than we need to have it. And the bigger fear now is that many of the big government funders, like the Global Fund and like the United States PEPFAR program, are telling their partners in the developing countries not to enroll new patients in these programs because of the limitations in funding that that will be available. Also, most of these programs are giving out first-line antiretroviral medications, which were effective for many people, but after a while, sometimes these first-line medications no longer work. And the second and the third-line medications are still very, very expensive, so out of the reach of governments from the developing countries. So there's still many big challenges for us to face in order to attain universal access for all who need it.
You'll be addressing a session on migration, won't you, related to HIV and AIDS, talking about what's described as spaces of vulnerability. Can you tell us more about what this means and the work that's going on with regard to migrant populations?
The specific issue that I will address in that program is how faith-based organizations work with migrant populations. And there are a number of major ways that I will highlight. One is that many faith-based organizations get involved in prevention education with people before they migrate from their countries to help them understand the dangers of HIV and of other sexually transmitted illnesses, and to help them understand why the Catholic Church counsels abstinence outside of marriage and fidelity within marriage. The second thing is that the Catholic Church gets involved in treating migrant people who are living with HIV, and that's especially important in many countries where migrants do not have the right to access the health services and the HIV services in countries countries that disqualify migrants from such access. And so I'll give you an example. In Botswana, many of the refugees coming from Zimbabwe cannot get any government aid if they're HIV infected, but the Catholic Church has a special program through funding with PEPFAR, the United States government agency, to be able to give those medications to people living with HIV. And that's true in a number of Eastern, Middle Eastern countries and in other countries throughout the world.
In 2009, Caritas launched its own very specific mother-to-child prevention campaign, didn't it? HEART, the highly active antiretroviral therapy. How successful has this specifically been in trying to help children avoid getting the disease?
That campaign has two parts. One is to promote greater access for pregnant women who are HIV infected to get access to these very simple medications that could prevent the transmission from mother to child. We have these medications. They don't cost a lot, and yet many, many pregnant women don't get access to them. So we want to scale up that program. That has made some progress, but not enough. And then the other part of the campaign is to advocate with pharmaceutical companies and with governments and research institutes to develop child-friendly dosages and formulations of the medications so that more children infected with HIV could live longer. And on that, we've made some progress. We now have about 5 or 6 child-friendly medications that are available in 6 dosages so that the child only has to take 1 dose of the medication per day. That are available to these children, and we're using them in many parts of the world. But still, we need additional formulations, and we also have practically no second or third line medications available. So if the first line medications fail with the child, then the child will get sick and will die very, very quickly. So the campaign has made some success. We certainly have had a number of very effective discussions with pharmaceutical companies. We also have been able to collect about 600 letters from children all over the world to government officials and to pharmaceutical companies begging that these medications be made available to their peers who are dying because of AIDS. And also Caritas Austria, and especially the Diocese of Caritas Feldkirch in Austria, has collected about 20,000 signatures on a petition to promote this campaign, and they'll hand these signatures over to the Austrian Government Foreign Development Office during the AIDS conference.
You're talking about some very specific initiatives to support the work of Caritas on HIV and AIDS. What is your message to people listening to this program? What else would you like people to do to support this work?
Well, first of all, I want them to know that AIDS is not over. We still have a major problem. It's still responsible for the deaths of many, many people, especially between 15 and 49 years of age. And when they die, their children become orphans. So although our media, especially in the Western world, does not speak so much about AIDS, it still is a major health crisis in the world. Secondly, I want them to be sensitive to the fact that even if they live in a country where AIDS is not a major problem any longer because of the access to the antiretroviral medications, still more than half of the people who need those medications in the developing world do not have such access. And so we need to encourage our government officials to continue their foreign aid and development monies so that we can help poor countries get access to those medications for their citizens. And finally, I want them to be especially sensitive to the issue of children with AIDS. If they don't have access to these life-saving medications, more than half of them die before their second birthday. That's a situation that's entirely preventable with the medications, and we should be outraged to think that so many infants and children are dying of AIDS in this world when we have medications that are available, but we simply are not spending enough money to make them available to poor children.
My thanks there to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to Caritas Internationalis, the global confederation of Catholic aid and development agencies. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.